I'm really excited by it. You know, the whole idea that we can predict the weather better, I think just in day-to-day life, it's quite nice. But in many cases, it can be a life or death scenario.
Welcome to Sidecar Sync, your weekly dose of innovation. If you're looking for the latest news, insights, and developments in the association world, especially those driven by artificial intelligence, you're in the right place. We cut through the noise to bring you the most relevant updates with a keen focus on how AI and other emerging technologies are shaping the future. No fluff, just facts and informed discussions. I'm Amit Nagarajan, chairman of Blue Cypress, and I'm your host.
Greetings and welcome back to the Sidecar Sync. We're here for another action-packed episode where we talk about exciting topics in AI and how they potentially could impact the association market. I'm here with my co-host Mallory, and we're ready to get going. But before we get started, here is a quick word from our sponsor today.
Today's sponsor is Sidecar's AI Learning Hub. The AI Learning Hub is your go-to place to sharpen your AI skills and ensure you're keeping up with the latest in the AI space. When you purchase access to the AI Learning Hub, you get a library of on-demand AI lessons that are regularly updated to reflect what's new and the latest in the AI space. You also get access to live weekly office hours with AI experts. And finally, you get to join a community of fellow AI enthusiasts who are just as excited about learning about this emerging technology as you are. You can purchase 12-month access to the AI Learning Hub for $399. And if you want to get more information on that, you can go to sidecarglobal.com/hub. Amit, how are you this week?
I'm doing great. It's been another one of those action-packed weeks for me. How about you?
I'm doing pretty great. I agree. It's been an action-packed one. And I'm scared to say it. Dare I say it? We're almost to the end of Q1. Is that crazy to you? I mean, we always say how fast time goes, but that's kind of hard to believe.
It is. And, you know, 3 months in our timeline is equal to like half of a doubling in AI timeline. So it's just crazy. It's moving along really fast. A lot of exciting things have been happening all over the place. I know we're going to talk about a couple of those or three of them today. But I think a lot of associations and a lot of nonprofits I'm talking to are really actively experimenting with AI. And that's exciting, too. That's probably more exciting than anything coming out of any of these labs.
Absolutely. Well, if we've missed that much in a week, it's probably time to get started here. The first thing I want to ask you, Amit, is actually not an official topic of our episode today, but it's an important news item that I wanted to get your thoughts on. On March 19th, it was announced that Mustafa Suleiman, co-founder of Inflection AI and DeepMind, would be joining Microsoft as executive vice president and CEO of Microsoft AI. He will be leading all consumer AI products and research, including Copilot, Bing, and Edge. Amit, what do you think about this piece of news?
I think it's a big win for Satya Nadella and the rest of the Microsoft crew. They've put together a string of big hits recently, and this is certainly a big one for them. Mustafa Suleiman is brilliant. He's one of the original DeepMind founders. He has done a whole lot of really interesting things as a research scientist within the AI field and as a business leader in the field, having been the leader of a $1 billion-plus funded startup called Inflection AI. That you mentioned, they have some very interesting technology that developed over the last couple of years. It seems as though Microsoft's doing their very best to not call this an acquisition. But it kind of smells like an acquisition in terms of the practical nature of it. So I think there were 70 employees at Inflection. I believe 65 of them are going to work for Microsoft, including Mustafa Suleiman. And in addition to that, they are paying, I think, something along the lines of $650 million to Inflection, which I believe is kind of like a bit of a consolation prize for the other investors. Microsoft was the biggest investor in Inflection AI. It was also backed by Reid Hoffman, who is a board member at Microsoft and best known probably for being one of the founders of LinkedIn, which was sold to Microsoft a few years ago. And so I think Inflection might have realized they're facing significant headwinds in terms of a consumer product, and also realized that they had some pretty interesting capabilities as a potential business service. And so Microsoft is going to be hosting Inflection's proprietary LLMs or models on the Azure cloud. I'll be interested in checking them out and seeing what they can do well. You know, all these models have their own unique personalities. So certain things, some models do really well and others do not. And I think inflections will be interesting to play with. But back to the question you had about, you know, the March 19th announcement by Microsoft, it's just another investment Microsoft is making to get really aggressive with AI across the board. The fact that Sullivan will be leading the consumer-oriented AI products, which will include, you know, all the things that Microsoft is doing, basically all fit into this area. Also AI research, and then the Copilot product across the Office suite and everything else is really interesting. So it's going to bring a degree of focus as well as research creds to Microsoft that they certainly are not lacking. They have a lot of credibility in the AI field within Microsoft Research and other areas, but it's going to be interesting to see what happens. So I'm excited about it. I've been a big Microsoft fan for a long time, certainly in the recent past, since Satya Nadella has been CEO. I think he's done amazing things there. And, you know, they're putting a lot of weight behind this. So this is, I think, just the latest chapter in that ongoing story.
It does indeed smell a lot like an acquisition. One more question, Amit. I saw that Mustafa wrote a book called The Coming Wave. Have you read that?
I did. I read it a few months ago when it came out. Great book. Really interesting book that talks about the acceleration of AI along with other exponential technologies. He particularly focuses on synthetic biology and how AI's acceleration and the acceleration of synthetic bio interweave in a way. So that's quite interesting. He also describes a strategy for dealing with AI's downside risk, broadly known as containment. I think he's a proponent of further research and pursuit of that strategy, which I think is interesting. So it's definitely a book worth reading if you're someone who likes to go really deep on these types of subjects. I don't think it's the best, like, first AI book you read type of book, but it's a very interesting book.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it sounds like something I would want to check out. Without further ado, we can dive into today's topics. We are first talking about humanoid robots. That will be a very interesting conversation. Then we're moving into Grok's AI chips, not to be confused with Elon Musk's Grok chatbot. They're spelled differently. Grok's AI chips is G-R-O-Q. And then our last topic of today will be all about AI predicting weather. A little bit different from what we normally talk about, but a really interesting topic as well. So first up, humanoid robots. OpenAI is partnering with robotics startup Figure to venture into integrating AI with humanoid robots. Figure is backed by a notable $675 million venture capital round from major tech entities, including Amazon's Jeff Bezos, Microsoft, NVIDIA, Intel, and OpenAI itself. Despite being a young company without a commercial product, Figure is making big strides with the support of industry giants, aiming to introduce millions of human-like robots for both professional and personal environments. The development and deployment of humanoid robots in workspaces have sparked varied opinions among robotics experts. While humanoid forms are engaging due to their relatability, practical implementation faces challenges. Traditional robots, often equipped with specific features for targeted tasks, contrast with the complex requirements of creating human-like robots capable of versatile, reliable movements and tasks. This discrepancy highlights an ongoing debate over the feasibility and utility of humanoid robots in practical operational settings. So in looking up this topic, I watched a video on YouTube. Amit, I think you watched the video as well. So I would highly encourage you all to check it out, but I'll give you kind of my take on it. So we saw the humanoid robot, which I would say is only human-like in its shape and voice. It definitely looked like one of those robots that you see on the movies where the robots take over the world. It was doing dishes and was apparently not actually trained on that specific task, but had learned to do it using computer vision, which, to give you a little bit more insight into that, is kind of like uploading an image into ChatGPT and then asking ChatGPT to describe that image. The humanoid robot actually sounded really human, which I know is probably a small thing in the greater sense of the world of AI, but it didn't sound like Siri, it didn't sound like Alexa, it actually sounded like you were speaking to a human. So, Amit, I want to hear your initial thoughts on this humanoid robot. And then people are calling it an AGI robot, or at least that's what all the headlines are saying. So I definitely want to get your take on that too.
I think the idea of humanoid robots and robots that take on the form of any number of different animal species is super interesting. For one specific reason, it's not about relatability. It has to do with the user interface. And what I'm referring to is the user interface to the world. our world is built around us. So driving cars, obviously, is one example of that. But just interacting with the 3D physical world is something that's designed for people. And so if you can plug a really intelligent humanoid robot into that environment, it can take on a lot of tasks. It can do a lot of really interesting things. Whereas robots that take on other forms, perhaps have wheels on them or treads or things like that, don't have moving arms, are shaped differently, are more likely to have challenges fitting into, you know, the user interface, if you will, of the world. So that's one of the reasons that it's such a compelling concept. Of course, it's extremely difficult because we are fairly complex machines. And, you know, when we think about it, you know, there's a long ways to go. So that video that you described, and we'll link to it in the show notes, is very interesting. It's a short video. It is, it goes beyond where most robotics have been able to go, specifically around the fact that it wasn't pre-trained, as Mallory mentioned, to do the tasks that were requested of it. So when we think about the advances in robotics that have occurred over multiple decades now, Boston Robotics has had a series of really cool videos over the course of a number of years where you can see robots doing a lot of different tasks, humanoid style robots doing a number of tasks, jumping, doing backflips, doing all sorts of cool things. And this robot doesn't do any of that. This robot is actually kind of standing still. I think it can move around, but really slowly. So on the one hand, you might be asking, well, okay, what's so novel here? I've seen videos like this before. The key is this. It wasn't trained to perform a specific task, whereas all the robotics that have occurred before are really very specifically trained to do particular things. So the Boston Robotics example of going through basically like a parkour type of environment, flipping and jumping and things like that, those were all things that the robot was specifically taught how to do, whereas the Figure 1 robot is essentially just powered by a general purpose AI model and is figuring things out as it goes. So in that video where the individual asked it to, I think, move a dish, another thing was the individual said, I'm hungry. And there was an apple nearby and the robot handed the individual the apple. So think about the reasoning required. The person didn't say, please hand me the apple, which is would by itself be quite interesting and difficult. It requires good vision. Obviously, the tactile capabilities to pick up the apple without crushing it, handing it to the person, the 3D depth perception to hand it appropriately, all that stuff. But in this case, what the individual in the demo did is said, I'm hungry. And said, Figure 1, I'm hungry. And Figure 1 translated that to, oh, you're hungry. Well, I see that there's food right in front of me. I can hand you this apple. And that was an example of something that was not trained. So there's some significant reasoning and planning capabilities, you know, implied by that video. Now we have to take the video at face value in terms of what they say. They say it was recorded at 1x speed. They say it was not pre-trained, et cetera. And I'm inclined to believe that. I think that, you know, the tasks are obviously somewhat limited still, but that's really the novel advancement is that it is doing generalized things without pre-training. It's using an advanced vision model. There's a lot of speculation around that. Is this powered by GPT-5 or some other, you know, advanced model? I suspect so. I don't think it's powered by the models that everyone else has access to right now, but that's just me speculating. And to me, while we're not anywhere close to an AGI robot, this is definitely not AGI, we've seen some interesting advances here. You know, the Tesla robot, the humanoid robot they're working on had some not exactly the same kinds of capabilities in terms of interaction, but it was demonstrating some really remarkable untrained skills as well. So I think we're going to see an explosion of capability here very, very soon.
Having a person say, I'm hungry, and then the humanoid robot know to pick up an apple, I think at a glance, from my perspective, and probably to our listeners as well, that sounds like some degree of reasoning. So why would you, what would be that line this robot would need to cross to consider this AGI?
Well, like the question is, how many steps need to occur in order to execute what's being requested of it? So I'm hungry. Here's an apple. Let me give you the apple. That's 2, 3, 4 steps. Certainly, it's non-trivial. It's remarkable that it can do that. But perhaps I might say, I have 4 people coming over for dinner. Prepare a meal by 6:30, and the robot figures out the plan. So what the executive function required is to think through that, think about the timing, think about breaking down the problem into lots of different subcomponents, and then executing all of that, right? So that would be much more advanced planning and reasoning capabilities. But we're seeing emergence of really true reasoning-like skills, you know, and so When we talk about reasoning in the context of language models, we often say that it simulates reasoning. It's a facsimile of reasoning, but it's not truly reasoning. And that is true in terms of the models not having the capacity to reason, because remember, these models are essentially predicting the next word. But who is to say that's not actually how we do our reasoning within our brains? We don't really know. So, but what's happening right now ultimately is, you know, AI researchers are looking at actually adding the ability to execute complex plans, to do these step-by-step or, you know, tree of search type plans we've talked about in prior podcasts, which would bring far more sophisticated reasoning and planning capabilities to the brains of these AIs. I don't think we're seeing that. I think what we're seeing is like an early glimpse into, you know, some basic operations.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned there's speculation that this humanoid robot is powered by GPT-5, for example. We don't have that inside information for sure. Where does the large language model fit into how this robot works?
Well, I'm guessing that they have some somewhat more advanced version of GPT-4 powering the robot that is capable of interacting with you. So the language unlock that we have through language models essentially allows us in near real time to basically make sense of language, right, in a digital context. So computers can understand language, they can generate language, very powerful. The way to think about the broader context here is that language is one piece and perhaps a small piece of the solution, both for AGI in the abstract sense, and then for the robotic encapsulation of AGI, which is where the robot obviously has an AGI capability. Let me describe what I mean. So language is a very small, narrow bandwidth application of thought. You have far greater ability to think than you have the ability to communicate it. And in fact, one way to think about this is if you think about information, we've talked about this in the past where, you know, if you're in an environment where you have a 3D experience and you have multiple senses, there's sight, there's sound, there's smell, there's touch, and there's a fully 3D immersive experience in the real world, or perhaps one day some very advanced feature virtual reality type environment, the amount of input you're getting, the amount of information you're getting is far greater than just reading text. Right. And somewhere between, say, reading text and that fully immersive live environment, you have other modalities like audio, video, et cetera. And what these models are learning is the 3D environment. So recently on this podcast, we spoke about OpenAI's Sora, which is their text to video model. They have not released. It's still a research project, but it's, you know, these stunning minute-long videos from a single text prompt. It's pretty amazing what they did there. And there's a lot of speculation on that project as well in terms of the world model, as they call it, that's backing it, meaning a world model that understands physical reality, understands physics, and has been trained on a much, much wider array of content, right? So I think that there's something like that going on in this robot, because the language model alone is very unlikely to give it the level of understanding that it seems to have through its vision model. So now these models are all ultimately, I think, going to blend together into, you know, maybe it's GPT-9, but, you know, some future type of unified model, which isn't to say that'll be the one model to rule them all. But the idea is that true AGI is going to have all of these things combined.
Okay, so we're seeing multimodality in this humanoid robot because of its ability to understand text and vision. But then are you also saying that it's multi-model in the sense that there's probably a few things stitched together here that we're not seeing?
Yeah, again, it's me speculating, but I would suspect based on it being, you know, early 2024, that there isn't a unified model that's powering that thing, that it's got a language model, that it's got a vision model, that it's got a few pieces that are engineered to come together as opposed to one big model. At least that's how I could see building something like that. If I were to try to attack that problem, it would be a decomposition of the various components you need. The question would be, are these models capable of interacting with each other with enough throughput, enough speed, low enough latency in order to, you know, do what you saw in the video? And I don't know the answer to that. But I think it's just an interesting time because regardless of whether it's separate models or one unified model that's powering, this robot, what it's able to do without pre-training, and that's the key, what it's able to do without pre-training is pretty stunning.
Mm. I don't want to get too in the weeds on this, but I think it's really interesting. What is inside? What do you think is inside the robot? Like if we cut it open, what would we see?
Probably pretty boring looking. You'd have a lot of actuators, you know, mechanical devices, motors that basically move the various joints and arms. And you'd have, you know, a lot of wiring and a lot of, you know, a lot of chips probably. I don't know what they have on board versus, you know, what it's connected to over the network. And this is a prototype, so it probably doesn't have, you know, as much onboard compute as it might need to have eventually. But, you know, as compute continues to advance and gets more and more compact and, you know, more energy efficient, I think you'll see onboard capabilities in these robots that is, you know, really like supercomputer level capabilities. And that might already be what you have in this particular device, right? Because, you know, one of the things about network interfaces is that there's latency. If you have this big giant computer on your network and the robot doesn't have that capability within it, it's going to have some amount of delay interacting with it. And so, you know, it might be one of these things where they've already advanced, you know, that capability. They certainly have the resourcing and not just money, but they have the right companies behind them between NVIDIA and Intel. Obviously, Microsoft, OpenAI is providing the model itself, or the models themselves. So I think that, you know, you'd find if you looked at it physically, I would suspect it would be probably not that interesting, but I think it's the software side of it to me is the big advance. I would put like one little asterisk next to this is that I'm not an expert at all in robotics, but one area that I know has been a challenge for a lot of years is tactile feedback and sensitivity, being able to like handle a variety of different kinds of objects, different shapes, things that are squishy, things that are soft, right? Industrial robots for a long time have been really good at handling like, you know, regularized geometries and like things that have like hard edges and stuff like that, moving boxes, moving crates, things like that. But this kind of thing where it's handling like a breakable dish or an apple is an advance. It's an interesting thing. And part of that's a processing speed capability, having enough feedback loops in the tactile feedback that's going to the robot's brain to adjust its settings. Whereas, you know, 20 years ago, we didn't have that capability. So it was a much bigger challenge.
Yep. I'll admit, I didn't even think about it needing to understand how to hold an apple until you said it, because I'm like, oh, it's an apple. You just picked it up. But it's like, yeah, what amount of force to hold that apple with so it didn't crush it. I think that's really interesting. And I guess talking about humanoid robots, my imagination is kind of running wild, but I'm thinking neural networks. I'm thinking like, what if one day we see some sort of not a real brain, but like some sort of AI brain thing inside these things. I don't know. That's just where my mind is going. But I'm curious, Amit, what do you envision humanoid robots being used for in the future, maybe personally and then professionally?
I mean, I think it'd be great to have these things handling a lot of things, a lot of the tasks people don't want to do. I mean, for me, it would be like, I'd love to have a robot that chases my kids to make them clean up their own room. I don't want the robot cleaning their room for them, but I want the robot chasing down my teenagers and telling them to clean up their room. So that would be my first application of figure one if I buy one of those down the road. But in all seriousness, though, there's so many things that there's labor shortages around. I know during the pandemic, it was just hard to get people to work in restaurants and working cleaning and all these other areas. And, you know, I think that the manifestation of AI in a physical form potentially solves a lot of those problems. Another really good example is in healthcare or in senior care. You think about nursing where, you know, shift labor is a challenge and like actually physically lifting a patient from a bed and doing that safely, doing that, you know, gently, all those kinds of things. Really hard for people to do that over and over again. It's bad for the backs of the nurses, right? So that's just one example. But there's so many applications where robotic labor could be a real boon. And of course, there's the usual concerns that come with any advancement in technology, like what happens to jobs. And those are valid concerns. And at the same time, you know, every time there's been significant advances in these types of technologies historically, over the long arc, there's been more net employment created by productivity gains and new creativity that's unleashed.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if you've heard about this, but there's a restaurant in Metairie, which is right outside of New Orleans for our listeners who don't know, that has robotic waiters bringing your food to your table. I think it's an Asian restaurant. I've never been. I've never seen them. I imagine that the robots are the most basic form of robots you can get. They have wheels and they deliver your food, but something to think about.
That'd be pretty cool.
All right. Topic two for today. You mentioned latency, Amit, which is a really good segue into our next topic on Grok's AI chips. Again, that's G-R-O-Q, AI chips. Grok has developed a specialized chip, the Language Processing Unit, or LPU, aimed at running AI models rapidly rather than training them. This focus on execution rather than training allows for high-speed, low-latency AI applications like real-time text-to-speech. Grok's approach contrasts with others targeting the AI training market, highlighting their unique strategy in a competitive field. The Grok chip's design is influenced by urban planning principles for efficient data flow. And just to give you some context on this, I did watch a video on the Grok chip as well, and it's incredibly fast. It wasn't sped up. It has the potential to write a full book in 100 seconds. And there were also some demos where people were interacting with a model running using the Grok chip. And there was really no awkward pause in between the asking the question and getting the response. So I think that was really unique to see. Grok focuses on reducing latency, like we said, and enhancing scalability through its cloud infrastructure with plans for global data center expansion. The current focus is on cloud-based applications, but future reductions in chip size could open possibilities for edge devices. Grok Chat, a consumer interface, has propelled Grok into the spotlight, offering low-latency AI for real-time language model interactions. The shift to running AI models, including the integration of open source models like Llama 2, highlights Grok's innovative approach to AI processing and its potential impact on this technology. So my first question for you, well, of course, I want to get your initial thoughts, but I read that Grok has been around since 2016. And given how impressive the video I saw was, why aren't we seeing Grok chips everywhere?
Well, so first of all, I think that, you know, that timeline is relatively short in the grand scheme of things. Building hardware is hard. And, you know, it's one of these things that takes time to go through. And the people behind Grok are former Google engineers who are involved in Google's tensor processing units and has some really interesting ideas here. The other thing to remember is that, you know, 2016 was right around the beginning of when generative AI really took off. You know, it was like the 2017 paper, which launched the transformer architecture and subsequent advances. Things took off, but in a way really slowly. So there wasn't that much demand compared to what there is now. What we have today is dramatically different demand-wise from what we had even 2 years ago. So there wasn't necessarily a strong need for the technology. And so the people who built Grok anticipated a mushrooming effect of growth in demand and a major choke point that exists in GPUs. So a GPU stands for graphics processing unit, but it is very general in nature. A GPU can do a lot of different things, and it does a lot of things quite well, but it's not specifically designed for just one thing. And the language processing unit, or LPU, that Grok is calling, that's what they call their chip, is designed just for one thing, which is not only specifically AI, but a subcategory of AI called inference. So within the world of AI, there's basically two major things that you need the chips for. You need something called need it for something called training, which is this long, expensive process where you take mountains of data and you train a model on that data set. And that is not something that LPUs will be used for. LPUs were designed strictly for inference. And that's the other side of it, which is inference is basically runtime. So the process of training, think of it as like the program being created, the AI being created. And once the AI is created, it's just a program that sits there. And when you want to run that program, you're doing something called inference. And that inference process is what Grok does really well. So it's designed specifically just for inference. And one of the ways they did that I think is interesting is they just created a much more streamlined path for the inference. The choke points that exist in GPU architectures are there because GPUs can do a lot of different things. And by designing the LPU to only do one thing really well, they've essentially eliminated those choke points. An oversimplification of this is just to say that, you know, they're able to access the memory they need to do what they do without going back and forth, like through multiple gatekeepers, which is what's happening in a GPU. So in the LPU architecture, you have a much more scalable, streamlined approach, but there's no scale yet in terms of their business. So there's not a lot of this happening. This represents a significant departure from obviously GPU architecture. And so for it to take off, you're going to have a lot of capital behind it. You need a lot of investment, a lot of growth. And that's going to drive, independent of tech advancements, economies of scale and manufacturing and distribution, which will make the chip more not only more available, but more affordable. Because it is pretty expensive right now if you want to buy Grok's chips. The other thing that's important to note about them is Grok has, they sell their chips And they also have a service where you can access two different models, two different language models through Grok's API. One is the Llama 2 model, the 70 billion parameter edition of the Llama 2 model. The other one is called Mixtral, which we covered on a previous episode of this podcast, which is an open source model from the French AI company Mistral AI. Both are awesome open source models, and Grok has them both running on their API. So if you're a developer and you want to check it out, you can go to Grok's website and you can get an API key and play with it. And it's stunningly fast. Like when you use it through API, it's nearly instant, just like what you experienced with Grok Chat, which is really not intended to be a ChatGPT competitor per se, but it just illustrates the power of their approach in terms of how fast these things are. So that's at a high level what I see here. I'm really excited about it because it represents the disruptive innovation. You know, the GPU world, people think of that as a new business and NVIDIA's meteoric rise in terms of market cap and all that. And really into the popular lexicon, nobody knew what NVIDIA was except for gamers maybe 5 years ago. And now all of a sudden everyone knows who they are. And GPU technology is not new. It's an older technology in concept. And that, by the way, doesn't mean it's bad. It's very important technology. But the idea of an LPU represents just another, you know, person or group of people saying, hey, there's a better way. And there's so much scale in devices these days that it makes sense to have highly specialized silicon for certain things. So I'm very excited about it. I think that you'll see, I don't know if Grok will succeed as a company. There's lots of variables that'll determine that. I think the concept will scale because people will build chips like Grok, and I think that market will blow up.
So it's safe to say that all the other models that we are using as consumers are using GPUs?
Yes, everything outside of the Grok chat and the Grok API is using traditional GPUs. I don't know of any like commercial offerings that are powered by Grok. I'm sure that will change. I know they've got a lot of investors. They're going to partner with different language model companies. I'm sure they'll partner with cloud companies. You'll see Grok powered, services emerge. But I'm not personally aware of any that exist commercially today. But if you want to check it out, checking out Grok Chat, like you were talking about earlier, Mallory, is a great way for people to get an idea of it. I will say there's one thing you have to keep in mind. So if you go to ChatGPT and use the latest ChatGPT-4 model in the paid version of ChatGPT, and you put in a prompt and you get this response, and it takes 10 seconds, 20 seconds to get the response, whatever it is. So you took that same prompt and you went over to the Grok chat and you put it in there, and it was nearly instant. It is a little bit of an apples to oranges comparison because not only the hardware is obviously different, right? That's what we're talking about here. But Grok only has enabled smaller models so far. Mixtral is an 8x7 billion parameter model, but it inferences roughly at around a 15 billion parameter model, meaning it's a small model. GPT-4 is a trillion plus parameter model. So, which in the architecture of these models is a really meaningful number because it definitely affects inference speed. So if you wanted to actually compare it, you might want to compare it to something like GPT-3.5, which if you run GPT-3.5 Turbo through the API or through ChatGPT, you can select it. It's way faster than GPT-4. So Grok is still like an order of magnitude faster, basically, but you need to kind of do an apples to apples comparison. So if you were to take like, you know, one of the larger new models and stick it on Grok, how fast would it be? It'll still be faster than GPU inference. But, you know, part of the demo being so impressive and saying we can, you know, do a book in 100 page book and or a book in 100 seconds or whatever. That concept, you got to remember, is based on much, much smaller models, too.
That is actually really helpful. I think that's what I was getting at, because seeing, you know, the demos of the Grok chips, I'm thinking, well, why isn't OpenAI running to them and saying this is what we want right now? Is it safe to say that when we're using ChatGPT, all we're seeing is inference? Like the training has already happened. All we're seeing is inference. So I'm still questioning, though, why don't you think all of these big companies like Google, like OpenAI, are kind of jumping to get Grok chips?
It wouldn't surprise me if they all were, and that they're all talking to Grok. There's probably acquisition offers. I heard an interview of the Grok founder, his name now escapes me, but talking about, you know, the acquisition opportunities, and people have been throwing, you know, multiple billions of dollars of offers at them. And, you know, he was saying, well, if someone offered us $100 billion, we'd consider it. And that might actually retrospectively be looked at as a bargain if someone were to lock up this technology, if it's protectable. You know, one of the things we got to remember is the concept behind Grok actually is a fairly simple processor architecture, which is what makes it powerful, and it's replicable. So the question is it protected? Is there enough of an IP moat around Grok where they'll really have a lock on that style of processor for a period of time? I suspect even if they do legally, other people will immediately come out with similar things and they'll fight it out in court. And that's often what happens is, you know, you take a large company that has a lot of resources and says, hey, I want to leapfrog NVIDIA. Like take Intel, for example. Intel has, you know, been seen as a laggard, probably rightfully so in many realms of AI. And they, for a long time, were the biggest chip manufacturer in the world, and they're not anymore. And so they might say, well, that's the category. We need to own that. And so perhaps they try to work with Grok. Perhaps they build their own version of it, you know. And so who's going to win in a court battle between Intel and Grok? And even if Grok were to win, it might take them 5 years to figure it out. So that's even when people know they're infringing on IP, sometimes they choose to do so thinking that the market's moving fast enough where it doesn't make a difference. So it might not be something we all agree with, certainly from an ethics perspective. That's certainly a concern, but that happens all the time in these environments.
So we've talked about GPUs and then LPUs, and maybe this already exists. Are there like vision processing units as well? Do you see that being the future of AI, is kind of having these really distinct chips for what functions we need?
Well, I think the LPU architecture theoretically would be great for powering any of these models, whether it's language or vision. There, I would think that it more of like an inference processing unit as opposed to language. I think that's probably a more convenient marketing term. But, you know, for anything that's based on kind of the current architectures we have out there, you know, vision models and language models and image models kind of operate in some similar principles in terms of the choke point that the LPU would alleviate. So I would think that would be very usable for all of those models.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like Grok chips are something to watch in the next few months, next few years, and or LPUs particularly.
I'd keep a close eye on it. I keep an eye on NVIDIA. NVIDIA just had a big announcement this week about their Blackwell architecture, which is, you know, really actually misunderstood, I think, a lot in the media right now as just being like an incremental step forward. But most people who are in the space are looking at it as a pretty significant leap in terms of processing capability. And on a cost perspective, actually, even though they have a pretty strong lock on the market, they're driving costs down a lot. Like if you compare the H100 and A100 architectures NVIDIA has had in the market for a while to this new architecture, basically the throughput you get from the new architecture on a per dollar basis is dramatically lower, which just goes back to the Moore's Law conversation we've had over a long period of time, that they, even though they have effectively a monopoly on these chips at the moment, are pushing those costs down as they advance power. So that's exciting to see as well. So let's just say NVIDIA is a $2 trillion market cap company, is not sitting on their hands when it comes to innovation like this. And I'd be surprised if they didn't have specialized chips up their sleeves beyond the GPU world.
Mm. Something to watch. In topic three today, we are talking about AI predicting weather. Google DeepMind has created two weather prediction models, MetNet 3 for short-term weather forecast and GraphCast for medium-term weather forecast. I didn't know this, so I had to look it up, but traditional weather forecasting relies on simulating physics of the atmosphere using extensive data from sensors and satellites to predict conditions. This method, while it is improving over time, requires significant computational power and can be time-consuming, it sounds like. In contrast, DeepMind's GraphCast uses AI, specifically graph neural networks, to analyze historical climate data. It operates on a single AI chip, reducing the need for supercomputing resources, and offers predictions more rapidly, showcasing a different and potentially more accessible approach to forecasting weather. GraphCast accurately predicts weather conditions up to 10 days ahead, outperforming the European Center for Medium Range Weather Forecasts in over 90% of tests. GraphCast predictions are notably precise in the troposphere, leading in over 99% of variables like rain and temperature. It provided early and accurate warnings for extreme weather events, such as Hurricane Lee's landfall prediction in Nova Scotia, 3 days sooner than traditional methods, showcasing its potential as a critical tool against climate change challenges. Amith, what are your thoughts on this?
I'm really excited by it. You know, the whole idea that we can predict the weather better, I think just in day-to-day life, it's quite nice. But in many cases, it can be a life or death scenario that's, you know, impacted by it. There's all sorts of things that happen all over the world where even a few extra hours of time to know that something imminent's about to occur can save lives and you know, save a lot of money as well. I think there's a lot of spaces where this will be, a lot of regions of the country this where this will be super valuable. I mean, Mallory and I are both down here in New Orleans, and New Orleans is known for its large storms. We talk about hurricanes, but what's less known to people who don't live here is we have lots of small storms, and these small storms can wreak havoc in the city. We have an antiquated pumping system and all these other issues here in our infrastructure. And so I'm not suggesting that if New Orleans had access to this tool that they'd necessarily improve the infrastructure in a way that would be reactive to that better forecast, although that's nice to think that they would. But in all seriousness, though, it would be very valuable to know what's going to happen sooner, right? I mean, predicting anything, you could say that, but weather has an effect on everything. It has an effect on agriculture. In some parts of the world, that can mean, you know, feast or famine, basically, if you better forecast weather over a period of time, and you can, you know, do a lot of things to, you know, protect crops and so forth. But when it comes to just the most basic use case of this, you can also have more granular forecasting where you have accurate forecasting down to a very small area. Whereas the models that are out there, European one, the American models, these are, you know, multi-billion dollar endeavors run in supercomputer environments that are, you know, multi-country collaborations. And they are based on traditional statistical models that are physics-based, and they don't use AI. They're using, you know, techniques that have been developed for decades that are really outside of the realm of what you'd call AI. And they've actually gotten quite good. You know, think about what we have compared to what we had even 20 years ago. But they're very general in nature because they model the world and you're looking for broader patterns. And there are some regional forecasts coming out of those systems. But if you could come down to like the per zip code or per postal code, right, level of granularity with the kind of accuracy we're talking about, that could be incredibly powerful for a lot of use cases. So because of the compute costs being so low for this, I think you could see that future happening. The other thing is, well, what would happen if GraphCast was scaled up beyond a single AI chip and you put it on a supercomputer, you put it in a massive environment and future versions of this that are even better? Can you forecast out 30 days? Can you forecast out 60 days, right? Can you forecast an entire season? Those are obviously exponentially more complex the further you go out in terms of the variables and conditions and all that. But, you know, I think those are sci-fi type concepts, right? To say I can forecast the weather with pinpoint accuracy 30 days from now. But I think we're going to be seeing that in the next decade or so.
I think that's really exciting for all of those of you who are just listening in and not watching on YouTube. I was definitely laughing at Amit's little part about New Orleans. That would be a whole nother episode, I think, Amit, if we had to talk about the beauty and the downsides of New Orleans. I'll say it like that. But for those of you that haven't dealt with hurricanes, you know, I can imagine how powerful this could be, because it seems with hurricanes, I mean, we have a lot of predicting power, but at the same time, things seem to just change, right? Like the day before, it might be a category 5, or maybe it's a 3, or maybe it's a tropical storm now. And so having even like a little bit more accuracy there in terms of preparation and really life or death situations in some cases, that seems so powerful to me. This information was released to the public back in November of last year. And something I struggle with a lot, the listeners can probably tell, and I'm sure you can tell too, Amit, is a lot of times that we'll learn about something or we'll discuss something. And in my head, I'm asking myself, why do we have such a lag? Like if this was out there in November, even though it's not really a lag, it was only a few months ago, but I'm thinking like, why isn't this everywhere? Why isn't this taking the world by storm? I think about that similarly within businesses too. Like, oh, we know we have this potential to get an AI chatbot. Why are AI chatbots not all over the world? What do you think about that lag, I guess? And how can you think about this realistically, the discoveries that we're seeing these days, and kind of how long we'll have to wait until we see them impact the world?
I think that's a fantastic line of conversation and question. I mean, you know, there's things take time to get new technologies into existing systems and displace current processes. In some cases, displace jobs or even entire organizations and institutions can take time. You know, you have to go through a period of time where you can really prove that this technology, I mean, it's out of the lab in the sense that they've, I think, done a very good job proving out that this is not a fluke. But I think testing this technology over a year or 2 years, testing it at scale in lots of different regions, reproducing it in different environments, those are the kinds of steps that appropriately we're going to want to see happen before we say, okay, it's time to just wrap up what we've been doing and shut down those data centers and all these different parts of the world that we really rely upon. So part of it is that it's really putting these things to the test, like at an industrial scale. I think that's important. Another part of it is just kind of wrapping our heads around what it means, like what we can do. If we're so used to one way of doing things, that's the human side of it is tough. That's the case with, I mean, a lot of the associations that are out there saying, well, we've always done things this way, or our industry has always done things this way. That's the part that's technology doesn't need change management. You know, we need change management. We need time to adapt to new processes. We need training and retraining. It's not the technology, but the technology is going to keep advancing, which is also helpful, because for as many exciting things there are with these technologies and others we talk about in this podcast, there's always downsides. And so you have to look for some maturity in some of these technologies before you fully deploy them. So I think that's part of it. I think also the other thing that people will start to realize is that there will be innovators out there who start to use these technologies to create new things. So, for example, in the insurance world, weather is a really big deal because insurers want to be able to build into their models for essentially pricing premiums for, let's say, property insurance for your home based upon predictions on weather. And so if these tools can get really, really good, then those risk profiles are more and more accurate, and it makes it possible for insurers to offer either more competitive prices or products that are not offerable if you don't have that level of granularity. And so if you think about disruptors potentially considering financial services, in this case, insurance, there might be some new companies that enter the space that are well capitalized and ready to compete that use these new technologies, and older firms that might be using, you know, previous generation technologies might be forced to catch up that way. But all these things take a bit of time to shake out. You know, another thing similar, I'm also quite impatient when I think about the advances and the good they can bring. When Google's AlphaFold was first talked about, which was the neural network a few years ago that cracked the protein folding problem, which is essentially this grand challenge in biology where you wanted to be able to predict the 3D shape and structure of a protein, which is an important concept because when you're thinking about something like drug discovery, you need to be able to understand that 3D shape in order to design a molecule to bind to it and to, you know, have the appropriate and desired therapeutic effects of that intervention. And so throughout the history of humanity, we've been able to manually do this protein folding problem, you know, basically by scientists doing that for a very small number of proteins. And AlphaFold basically cracked the code through AI and was able to, with incredible accuracy, I think predict something like 20 million proteins. And that was a few years ago. And when that happened, people were saying, oh, this is going to unleash all sorts of new innovation in terms of new medicines and life-changing therapies, and it's going to be amazing. And to date, we haven't seen anything that I'm aware of. I'm pretty sure nothing's hit approval with the FDA. So it doesn't mean nothing's happening. You know, there's companies that have been formed, including actually one within Alphabet, the parent company of Google, that's taking this technology, this AlphaFold type technology, improving upon it, of course, and then designing drugs. In fact, there was a recent interview with Demis Hassabis, who's the CEO of Google's DeepMind unit and also runs Alphabet's business that's focused on these kinds of therapeutics. And he was talking about heading towards FDA approval for a couple of really interesting new drugs in the near future. So that's an interesting space because you obviously have the innovation pipeline taking a period of time, maybe a couple of years, maybe a few years to figure out how to use the underlying general purpose tech. And then, of course, in that example, you have the FDA process or the regulatory body in each country that you have to get through, which that can take years. So I think in some ways, in spite of my own preference for being impatient, you kind of have to be patient at times with some of this stuff.
It makes sense. I get what you're saying and where you're coming from. I guess just hearing all of this, the conversations that we have on this podcast, but particularly the advancements we've seen in other fields, I feel a sense of hope, which I think is just exciting and important when talking about AI, when a lot of the news out there is around fear of what's to come, thinking about how many problems on Earth this could solve. I mean, you talked about the protein folding. We've talked about material science on this podcast. Now, weather, just thinking that, you know, maybe in 10 or 20 years, the major issues, climate change that we're facing, we might be able to address with AI. I'm very hopeful on that. And I guess that's where the impatience is stemming from.
100%. And, you know, you think about something like solving energy. And if we think about, well, the combination of, small, compact nuclear reactors, fission reactors for energy, coupled with the possibility of cracking fusion These are there are many different problems there, but the fundamental physics, I think, is pretty well understood in all of these cases. And we have some engineering problems, including material science, materials engineering type problems. And so when you think about AI entering the fold as this incredible assistant to the material scientists and physicists who are working on those kinds of problems, that's exciting because that gives us so many more opportunities to really look at these problems from different angles. So I think we're really going to see this abundance in all of these fields explode in the coming decade or so. It's going to be exciting to see.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other fields you're excited about in terms of AI advancement that we haven't talked about thus far?
I mean, there's so many. I mean, they all kind of they're interwoven in a sense. One of my favorite books, it's a little bit older now, but I think it's one that is still worth reading, is this book called Abundance by Peter Diamandis. It's about, I think, 12 or 13 years old, but it essentially talks about these exponential curves, and actually looking back at it a few years later, you know, some of the predictions that were made in there were pretty accurate. And it talks about, you know, seven different exponentials coming together and how that's going to usher in an era of abundance. And the same author, Peter Diamandis, wrote a book actually right before the pandemic, beginning of the 2020s, called The Future is Faster Than You Think, which is kind of like an update to abundance. And he talks about some similar themes and what's going to happen this decade. And so far, I think that book's actually pretty close to on track. In fact, he might have been a little bit conservative in some of his thoughts because he wasn't really talking that heavily about AI in 2020.
Well, I was going to say he's probably way overdue then for another version of that book, given everything that's happened since 2020.
Yeah, I'm a fan of his writing and his blogs and stuff like that. He's always out there putting out new content. So I think we'll see something new pretty soon, is my guess too.
All right, Amith. Well, that's all we've got for today. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for tuning into Sidecar Sync this week. Looking to dive deeper? Download your free copy of our new book, Ascend, Unlocking the Power of AI for Associations at ascendbook.org. It's packed with insights to power your association's journey with AI. And remember, Sidecar is here with more resources from webinars to boot camps to help you stay ahead in the association world. We'll catch you in the next episode. Until then, keep learning, keep growing, and keep disrupting.